from PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Well, love may make the world go round, but oil is what keeps the economy humming. Rarely has the value of black gold been so apparent as in the last few months. Just consider America's troubled relationship with Saudi Arabia, the world's biggest oil producer, but also the country that gave us Osama bin Laden and most of the September hijackers. Today we'll look at the politics of oil. Also, are we running out of this precious fuel? And a glimpse into the future without oil.
If you have your fuel cell vehicle and you then drive it to work and leave it turned on and sell power back all day long while at work, then hop in your fuel cell car and drive home, plug it into your house and generate the power you need at night, you then have this remarkable device that provides power where you are.
Is the war in Afghanistan really a war about oil? I mean, would the September 11th attacks have happened? Would we even know who Osama bin Laden is if there were no American soldiers stationed in Saudi Arabia protecting U.S. oil interests? Probably not, says international security expert Michael Clare.
This is essentially a conflict between Osama bin Laden and the royal family of Saudi Arabia, the regime that now governs that country. And the United States is a party to that conflict because we protect the royal family. And we're in that country because of oil.
I guess the real question I have to get an answer to is, how dependent are we on Saudi oil?
If you look just in terms of the percent of oil that Saudi Arabia provides the United States, we could probably do without Saudi oil in the short term because there are other supplies. But Saudi Arabia has more oil than anywhere else in the world, and over the long haul, the United States will need more and more of it. We also need Saudi oil because it keeps the price low. Saudi Arabia provides so much of the world's oil that by pumping it the way it has, it's kept prices relatively low, and that's good for our economy.
You mentioned that the percentage we get from Saudi Arabia right now is not all that high. Can you estimate for me how much of our oil actually comes from Saudi Arabia?
My guess is it's in the range of 10%. I'm sorry I don't have the precise figure, but it's in that range.
It doesn't seem like very much. That means 90% of our oil comes from other places.
Well, about 40 to 45% of our oil comes from domestic U.S. sources. So if we're looking at imports, then Saudi Arabia's share goes up. It is one of the two or three leading suppliers, along with Nigeria and Venezuela. Those are the principal suppliers to the United States. So it is very important. But Saudi Arabia's oil is crucial to the international petroleum economy. It is the world's leading supplier. Much of that oil goes to Europe and to Japan, and so keeps the whole world economy afloat. If Saudi Arabia was taken out of the picture, we could still find oil, but the global economy could crash.
Has this relationship been the same for a long time? I mean, how far back does our U.S. government relationship with the Saudi royal family go?
This is a very interesting question, because if you go back to 1943, you'll see that we didn't even have relations with Saudi Arabia. We didn't recognize the government there, had no ambassador or embassy in the country. But during World War II, we discovered that the United States would run out of oil at some point in the future, and U.S. policymakers determined that we had to have another major source of oil, and they agreed that Saudi Arabia was the best place to go because it literally has more oil than anyone else. And so Franklin D. Roosevelt, the president at the time, met with King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, the founder of the royal family, at that time the king of Saudi Arabia, and made a deal with him in 1945, shortly before his death. Roosevelt worked out a deal with King Abdulaziz whereby the U.S. would provide protection to the royal family in return for privileged access to Saudi oil. And that agreement remains the basis of U.S. ties with Saudi Arabia today.
Protection for the Saudi royal family, was that defined at all?
It has been defined in a number of agreements and understandings, never quite explicitly in public print, but we do know that the agreement called for the U.S. to protect Saudi Arabia not only from its external enemies, from other countries in the region, but also from internal enemies. And so the U.S. plays a very important role, has played a very important role in developing Saudi Arabia's internal security forces, like the Saudi Arabian National Guard, which is the primary counterinsurgency force in the kingdom, heavily equipped, trained, and advised by the U.S. Department of Defense.
Did the U.S. have much of a military presence in Saudi Arabia before the Gulf War?
It was a presence. It was a modest presence, rather inconspicuous, because most of the American military personnel were actually working for defense contractors. They were what you might call white-collar mercenaries. They wore suits and ties. Most of them were retired military personnel, and they worked in the headquarters of the Saudi Arabian National Guard and the various Saudi military agencies as advisors, as logistical experts, communications experts. So we were deeply entrenched in the Saudi military machine, but it wasn't very conspicuous in the sense of large bases with many, many thousands of soldiers.
And that changed then once the war began. And since the war, I gather, we have had a pretty steady U.S. military presence there. That's more obvious?
It certainly is a much more substantial presence. But I should say that it's this presence of American soldiers on Saudi land that is one of the most significant factors in the opposition to the royal family by supporters of Osama bin Laden. They believe that Saudi Arabia is the holy land of the Islamic people because Mecca and Medina are located there, and they resent the presence of so many non-Muslims, or infidels, as they're called.
But it's a relatively recent American presence there, which suggests that this part of the opposition to America is also relatively recent. I mean, we went there in force to fight the Persian Gulf War, won that, more or less. And at the end of that, most people would have said that Iraq was defeated. The Palestinians who had been there with Iraq were discredited. Nobody seemed to be objecting then to America's military presence. What's happened? Why is it different?
Certainly, there was objection made in 1991 after the Persian Gulf War, when those troops didn't leave the kingdom. You know, originally they were brought in as a kind of emergency short-term measure, but then they stayed on. And that's when things started to turn ugly. It's really in these past 10 years that you see a hardening of anti-Americanism in Saudi Arabia and other countries. And it's connected to a number of things all happening simultaneously. One is the fact that those bases in Saudi Arabia are used for attacks on Iraq and for maintaining the economic sanctions on Iraq, which are viewed by many people in the Arab world as unfairly punishing the ordinary Iraqi population. That is, they leave Saddam Hussein relatively unscathed, but they cause great suffering for the poor people in Iraq. So that stirred up a lot of resentment.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions that may be at odds with each other. One, how much of a problem would it be for the U.S. if the bases were not available to them in Saudi Arabia? And I guess the other, I don't know which one you want to address first, is what would happen to Saudi Arabia if the U.S. military left?
Those are good questions, and I think people are struggling to figure them out right now, both in Washington and Riyadh. Certainly, the U.S. could get by without the bases if it had to, but it would be difficult. We'd have to probably rely a great deal more on aircraft carriers, and we would have to devote a good part of our aircraft carrier fleet to that purpose, because for each carrier you have on station in the Gulf, you have to have one that's being replenished and giving people home leave and being repaired and overhauled and that sort of thing. So it would be a great strain on our aircraft carrier fleet if we couldn't use those bases. But now, what about the royal family? I think that they're very worried right now about their future, and I'm not sure they know exactly how they're going to get out of this predicament.
One of the things that we've read a lot about in the last couple of months since September 11th is the support that seems to have been provided by the Saudi royal family or the Saudi civilization as a whole for this particularly virulent brand of Islamic militants. I mean, Osama bin Laden is from Saudi Arabia. It appears that most of the hijackers in those planes were from Saudi Arabia. Has there been support, financial support at least, for the men we call terrorists?
This certainly is a history whereby the royal family has attempted to buy off possible opposition from its Islamic critics by giving money to charities set up by the various religious sects in Saudi Arabia, giving them money for use in building mosques and hospitals and so on. And it's very likely that some of this money has flowed into the coffers of Al-Qaeda or through front groups that it operates in Pakistan and elsewhere. This derives from this predicament that I was describing that the royal family finds itself in. It has silenced most of the political opposition. After all, there's no free press or free assembly in Saudi Arabia, but there is a very large and active religious community, Islamic community. And there has been criticism of the royal family by the religious community because many of the royals have been known to go off to Europe and Beirut and be seen gambling and with prostitutes and that sort of thing. They don't lead quite the ascetic life that supposedly they're upholding. So to kind of buy off the possibility of religious opposition, the royals have given a lot of money to these charities. And as I say, some of this has probably gone to Osama bin Laden.
Well, let's talk about it for a minute, though, because everybody now seems to admit that this problem exists and to talk about why support of the royal family may be causing some of the dissent within the Arab world. Certainly, there must be people who are saying, how can we lessen our dependence on Saudi Arabia? What if we were to allow some more democratization of the Saudi government? What if we were to pressure the monarchy to offer its citizens more freedom? Are these discussions taking place, or is that forbidden?
Well, if they're taking place, it's certainly not evident to the outside observer. I've seen absolutely no hint of this. And, you know, you could look back to the situation in Iran. We found ourselves in the same mess there. We were so closely associated with the Shah of Iran that when the opposition took over, as they finally did, they were furious at the United States, and we're paying the price for that today. I worry that the same thing is happening in Saudi Arabia because we're so closely identified with the royal family. We could pay a high price when and if they depart, and I think their departure is inevitable. So I think we'd be much better off, frankly, if we were trying to promote democracy now and looking for partners outside of the royal family who oppose Osama bin Laden on one hand, but who are ready to move in a more democratic direction within the country.
Is that what we need to do? I mean, is that what you think U.S. policy should pursue now, is other possible governments within Saudi Arabia, other people with whom to ally ourselves?
Well, I think the correct thing to do would be to put pressure on the royal family to make plans to establish a blueprint for the progressive democratization of the country. I don't think we should just drop out of sight overnight. That would lead potentially to a lot of chaos and violence, not something we would want to see. But I do think we could tell the royal family to create some kind of parliamentary process and to, over time, give that parliament, or whatever it would be called, more and more power so that eventually you'd have a constitutional monarchy, as you see in the nations of Europe. I don't think this is such an extreme or difficult idea to grasp.
Michael Clare is a defense analyst based at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. He's the author of Resource Wars, The New Landscape of Global Conflict. Coming up, the story of Ken Saro-Wiwa, the Nigerian activist who took on Shell Oil and his own government.
he was sentenced to death, and 10 days later, despite worldwide protests, he was hanged.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. In 1995, human rights leaders around the world tried to save Ken Saro-Wiwa's life. The Nigerian activist had been arrested on a trumped-up charge of murder after he'd rallied hundreds of thousands of Ogoni people to protest against Shell Oil. Those pleas for mercy went nowhere. The government executed Saro-Wiwa. And now his son, Ken Wiwa, has written a memoir, In the Shadow of a Saint. It's a bittersweet story. And not just because of the way Saro-Wiwa died. While Wiwa revered his father, he also resented his dad's dominating presence. But as he told Steve Paulson, Wiwa never doubted the importance of his father's crusade.
Nigeria is the sixth largest oil-producing country in the world, and yet there are some shocking statistics in terms of GDP and infant mortality and such, you know, all the indices of development. And so my father was really targeting the misuse of this oil wealth. And for him, what really pained him was that most of this oil came from the south, where our people, the Ogoni, are, and our people, the oil hadn't been used to develop our people.
And to put this in perspective, I mean, you've mentioned that Nigeria has this tremendous reserve of oil, one of the major oil producers in the world, but there's incredible poverty in the country. And in fact, the government has been in debt. Billions of dollars in debt.
Yeah, the government's about $30 to $40 billion worth of debt. So, you know, unborn generations of Nigerians will be saddled by this debt. And what's interesting is it's been estimated that the amount of unaccounted for money in foreign bank accounts for individuals, Nigerian individuals, is roughly equal to the foreign debt. So it's quite clear what's happening in Nigeria, that, you know, a small elite is mortgaging the future of the country. Because there's no sort of culture of accountability. And my father was really called them to task and pointed out all this and really mobilized people's opinion as to what was happening in their country.
Well, and your father was a man of many talents. He was not only a political organizer, he was a newspaper columnist for a while, a satirist. He was a novelist. He really had his finger in a lot of different fields.
Yeah, and he was a businessman too, very successful businessman. And a playwright, and wrote, scripted, and even acted in Nigeria's biggest sitcom. So, yeah, he was a man of many, many, many parts, and loved and loathed in equal proportion, I think.
Tell me about the event that ended up landing him in prison and eventually led to his execution.
Well, in 1990, he decided to form a movement, a grassroots environmental movement, the Movement for the Survival of Ogoni People. By 1993, in just 3 years, 300,000 of Ogoni people, out of the 500,000, three out of every five Ogonis came out in support of the aims and ideals of MOSOP. And, you know, Shell was declared persona non grata in Ogoni until they cleaned up the environment and paid rents. And this really terrified the Nigerian military.
Because the military had a close relationship with
Shell. A close relationship with Shell. 90% of foreign earnings comes from oil. So for them, you know, oil is very much their lifeblood. And once it becomes threatened by a small community like Ogoni, they feared that this kind of protest and unrest would spread across the Delta, where there are other communities much bigger and much more, with a much more powerful voice than the Ogoni. So they went out to make an example of my father. And he was arrested five times in all. And MOSOP as a movement, the leaders of MOSOP, were variously intimidated and bribed into silence. But my father refused to, despite the warnings, the coded warnings, he refused to stop campaigning. And eventually, on May the 21st, 1994, four allegedly pro-government MOSOP leaders or chiefs, Ogoni chiefs, were brutally murdered by a rampaging mob. And my father was arrested in connection with the murders.
He was charged with inciting the mob.
Well, he was held for 9 months without charge, but when he was charged, he was in charge with inciting the mob to murder the men. And even though they couldn't find any evidence that he did actually incite them to murder the men, And the presiding judge said of a military tribunal that tried him, said he must have known of the circumstances leading up to the men's death. And so he was sentenced to death. And 10 days later, despite worldwide protests, he was hanged.
We've been talking about the very public role that your father, Ken Sarawiwa, played in Nigeria in organizing this whole movement against Shell in particular and against the military regime. Toward the end, you became a very active spokesman, campaigning, trying to get his release. But you had had a very troubled relationship with him as you were growing up.
Troubled and complicated. I mean, I think my father was quite a forceful personality. I think for me, I was his first son, and I was. It was made very clear very early on that I was going to inherit the earth, his earth.
You were supposed to enlist in his causes, among other things.
Yes, in his causes, in his businesses. Everything he was doing was set up so that I could take it on. You know, I was even named Ken Sarawiwa as well. So, you know, as a child, I was very much aware. I mean, growing up, my father was my hero. He was a man I adored more than anybody else in the world. But I think as a child, there comes a time when you begin to look to other models of manhood. And really the time, though I was born in Nigeria, when I was 10, I was sent abroad to school in England. And when you leave one culture and move to another culture, there is a sense that the kind of man that your father is molding you into isn't the kind of man that you think is going to be able to survive in a different culture, for one thing. I guess because I'm like my father, I'm stubborn. And
you didn't want to just do what he was telling you to do.
I didn't want to do what he was telling me to do. So we had this ongoing battle, which was waged really on two fronts, on my cultural identity and also my personal identity. In a sense, you know, my father wanted me to be his son, his African son, even though I was being educated in England.
And he was the one who sent you off to England.
And he was the one
he wanted to make sure that all of his sons went to the best boarding schools in England.
We went to the best boarding schools in England. The whole idea was that we would come back and inherit his world, his earth in Africa. And so, of course, the more he insisted on that, the more I cut off my nose to spite any traces of his face in me. And so I became everything he didn't want me to become. But, you know, when my father was arrested for what turned out to be the final time, of course, you know, I had no choice but to become his spokesman, become all the things that I had resisted for so long.
I want to talk some about this, I suppose you could call it this conflict of cultures between Nigeria and England in this case. I mean, you must have felt very torn when you were basically being schooled in England for many years. And you write that while you spoke with your mother in your local language, Kana, you always talked with your father in English.
Yeah, that was a curious thing. You know, my father was this very African man, this public African man, very proud of his roots as an Ogoni, as an African, insisting that his children be given the best education in English abroad, but to come back to Africa. And whilst he remained behind in Africa, I lived in England with my mother. And the curious and the ironic, deeply ironic thing for us, and what really made the whole thing so confusing as a child growing up in my father's house, was that he always spoke English to us. The only thing that kept me really connected to my roots was speaking Kana, our language. And the only person who helped me keep that connection to my roots was my mother.
Well, and politically, it gets even more complicated, because if you think about the history of Nigeria, it was a colonial state of the British.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, is that although my father is very much an African nationalist to a certain extent, he's a product of British colonialism, because he was educated in a British colonial school with the British curriculum and all the... You know, he enjoyed Dickens and Shakespeare. I mean, the man loved, he was forever quoting Shakespeare. And he was a very cultured man, and his library was just this extensive thing and had all the great works of English literature. I mean, he enjoyed French and Russian literature too, but...
But did he rail against the history of what the British had done
in your country? He did. That, see, there's, again, another one of the magnificent contradictions that is Ken Sarawiwa's, that... You know, he railed against a British company like what Shell was doing to his people. He railed against the impact of colonialism on Nigeria. There's a sort of peculiar irony in that, I guess.
So here you were being schooled in these British boarding schools, being taught the fine points of English culture. Did you feel alienated from Nigeria? I mean, did you want to go back? Did you assume that you were going to go back?
I felt an ambivalence about Nigeria, which I still do. I also have an ambivalence about England, too. You know, my sense of belonging is I don't really have a sense that I belong anywhere fully. When I was growing up, of course, really in rejecting my African identity and roots, all I was actually doing was really rebelling against my father. So once that process of rebellion has passed, and it has now, there's this sense that what I'm left with is needing to embrace the country that I was born in and the country which really houses me, I suppose, in many respects. But, you know, it's a question of stripping away the bad memories which the country has been associated with, including, you know, my father's murder and hanging, and embracing the country on a much more optimistic level. And I'm working towards an accommodation with it. But it's difficult. I always say that I don't like going to Nigeria, but I don't like leaving it either. Hmm. So that's a struggle which I'm still trying to work out, and trying to work out by going there as often as possible, and I go back, you know, 3 or 4 times a year.
Ken Wiwa, talking with Steve Paulson about his memoir, In the Shadow of a Saint.
Oil money can lure a man away from home, and I was one of many boys who set off on his own. Oil money, a million jobs in the oil trade, $1 million waiting to be made.
For all the hand-wringing about the politics of oil, and the repression in countries like Nigeria and Saudi Arabia can make anyone queasy, there is an even more basic problem. Just how much oil is left on this crusty old earth? Geologist Ken DeFace believes we'll soon start to run out.
In the case of world oil production, we're so close to the peak now, we're only predicting about 4 years ahead.
And the year 2005 is, of course, just around the corner. So if this estimate's right, if the world's oil production will soon shrink, then we're in big trouble. Ken DeFace grew up in Oklahoma's oil country, where his father was a petroleum engineer. Ken followed in his dad's footsteps, working for Shell Oil before going on to an academic career at Princeton. And if you're a John McPhee fan, you'll know him as the science expert in McPhee's books about geology. Well, now DeFace has written his own book, Hubbert's Peak, The Impending World Oil Shortage. The title refers to geophysicist M. King Hubbert, who predicted in 1956 that U.S. oil production would peak in the early 70s. At the time, Hubbert was widely ridiculed, but his prediction proved to be right on target. He made his calculation by plotting a bell-shaped curve based on the amount of oil already produced and how much still remained in the ground. Hubbert saw a pattern. Production shoots way up at first as the cheapest, most accessible oil is tapped, but then it drops when extraction gets tougher and more expensive.
My analogy is, if you're a bass fisherman and you go to your favorite bass pond, you notice after a while that you're catching fewer bass. And as the bass catch gets leaner and leaner, you could go to the fishing tackle store and buy fancier and fancier rods and reels and lures to try to catch those reluctant bass that are in the bottom of the pond. But the other possible conclusion is you've caught most of the bass and there's no point fishing that particular pond anymore.
DeFace recently plotted his own bell curve for the world's oil supply, and that's why he thinks production will start to slip in just a few years. But it's a controversial claim. Bjørn Lomborg is a Danish statistician who studied the numbers and has written his own book, The Skeptical Environmentalist.
The main reason why the U.S. stopped producing oil is simply because it's cheaper to produce it elsewhere.
Lomborg says people have been warning about a coming oil crunch for decades, kind of like the boy who cried wolf.
If you look at the data, you can say, well, if you take the number of years that you thought you had left over basically take 1920. We know how much energy we used in 1920. We also know how much oil we thought was left over. And then if you divide those two numbers, you get like there was 10 years left over of oil. So a lot of people would say we're going to run out of oil in 10 years. Well, actually, in 1930, there was still about 10 years worth of oil at this new higher level of consumption. And actually, if you go through the numbers, we've never had as much oil left over as we have now. And we never have used as much as we are using right now per year.
In recent years, the Middle East has been the world's biggest single source of oil. But Princeton's Ken DeFace says production there just peaked. And he doubts the much ballyhooed Caspian Sea reserves in Central Asia can pick up the slack.
The Caspian Sea region is very likely not as big as the Middle East. And what we need to bail ourselves out now is to find a whole additional Middle East. The biggest unexplored place is the South China Sea because six different countries claim it, and there are several rocks out in the middle of the South China Sea whose ownership is disputed.
Those countries include China, Malaysia, Indonesia, and the Philippines, which means you can expect quite a squabble if the oil motherlode is really found there. But Bjorn Lomborg, the statistician from Denmark, says we don't need some great untapped oil reserve.
Most people believe that we at least have 50 years left over of oil, and if we take all the oil that we still haven't discovered or we still don't know how to extract, we probably have anywhere from 100, 150 years of oil consumption left over. However, we also have shale oil enough within the next 25 years to cover about 100, 200, maybe even 500 years more.
And Lomborg doubts that we'll even need fossil fuels in a few decades because the price of renewable energy is dropping so fast. But Ken DeFace says this is no time for Pollyannas. He believes we'll soon feel the pinch.
One possibility is that there would be very large price rises and we'd drive less because we couldn't afford it. Another possibility is that we saw during the 1980s was rationing by inconvenience. There were long lines at the gas stations, although the price was regulated. And then the third possibility was rationing by coupons, as in World War II.
So it really comes down to which vision of the future you believe and which experts you trust. Because the consequences get very personal. Are you going to tool around in that monster SUV or brush the cobwebs off your bicycle?
I really want to see you, Jane, but my car ain't got no fuel.
Ain't got no gas.
You know, I tried to come over last night, but it ain't got no fuel.
Ain't got no gas.
The way things are going, I might as well get me a new.
Get me an ass. Get that gasoline. Get that gasoline.
Oh, baby.
Get that gasoline. Get that gasoline.
Morning to the gallon.
Baby, your rest room sure are clean.
Ashland Marathon, Gulf City Marathon, Mexico, West Coast, Anderson, Old Coast, Super Shell, Mobile, sure pure hump.
What will the world look like after oil? A few good guesses coming up. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. At some point, the world's oil reserves will run out. This predicament got our special correspondent, Doug Gordon, thinking about the energy of the future.
Ever since I saw the new computer-animated film Monsters, Incorporated, I've been thinking a lot about alternative sources of energy. In the movie, the city of Monstropolis uses children's screams as a source of fuel. Now, of course, children's screams won't solve our real-life energy crisis, but Monsters Incorporated has inspired me to come up with two much more practical alternatives to the usual alternative sources of energy. Number one, why don't we just clone some dinosaur DNA so that we can create more dinosaurs? Then we'll kill all the dinosaurs and use their decomposed remains for more fossil fuel. Sounds a little too much like Jurassic Park? Perhaps. Okay, how about this? We don't kill the dinosaurs, we use them as public transit. Kind of a Flintstones type approach. And those people who aren't willing to take public transit are welcome to drive their cars under one condition. Their cars must be reconfigured so that the fuel that powers them is their very own feet. The added bonus is that this will create a lot more work for podiatrists. And let's face it, podiatrists have got kids to put through college just like the rest of us. Don't like this idea? No problem, because I have saved my best idea for last. What are the two fuels that keep human beings going? That's right, coffee and cola.
Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola, things go better with Coca-Cola, things go better with Coke.
So I propose that we do a little bit of cold, refreshing fusion.
And Coke refreshes you best?
It's the refreshingest.
We combine the two to create a powerful new source of fuel, coffola, or coli. Just as long as we don't call it coffla. That sounds like you've got phlegm in your throat. Anyway, this coffola could be the ethanol of the new millennium. All we have to do is create some revolutionary new kind of vehicle that is powered by this coffola. And I'm sure that Starbucks will be only too happy to reconfigure their millions of stores into service stations, where both we and our cars can fuel up. Everyone knows that you can't go two blocks without seeing a Starbucks. Heck, I think they've already opened their second location in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Maybe that's where Dick Cheney is hanging out these days.
I'll have an ice coffee. Hold the ice.
We'll never have to worry about running out of gas again. Oops, I mean coffola. So come on, barista, fill her up, and fill me up, and fill up my gas-guzzling SUV with the cool, refreshing, energy-efficient taste of coffola.
Things go better with Coke.
Coffola.
Okay, so maybe coffola isn't really the wave of the future, but various engineers and scientists are developing and refining new energy sources, from wind farms and hydrogen fuel cells to more exotic gizmos, like space-based solar panels that beam microwaves down to Earth. Daniel Kamen runs the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Lab at the University of California, Berkeley. He told Anne Strainchamps about the latest developments.
The most exciting thing going on is that a whole variety of things that were technically feasible or were theoretically feasible a number of years ago are now practical today. So, for example, fuel cells, which are essentially a battery run backwards. You put in hydrogen on one side and oxygen on the other, and you get electricity and warm water. That's it. Fuel cells are now at a point where they are being deployed in buses and in cars starting in the year 2002. And they are already available for homes or small businesses, and the number of companies working on them is growing rapidly. One of the amazing things with fuel cells is that they transform how we think about energy. So they are a very critical technology. By transform energy, what I mean is that in the past, you generate electricity, and you have to use it right away. It's on the market. It's sort of an instantaneous commodity. Fuel cells allow you to generate electricity and also to store it, because what you do is you produce hydrogen, move it around, and then use that as the input, your fuel, later on. So it transforms this kind of immediate supply and demand market.
Wait, so put this in more practical terms. I mean, how might I, 3 years from now, be using fuel cells in my life?
Well, let me give you two examples. One is that instead of your furnace in your basement, you could have a fuel cell, which is about the size of your furnace, and that can generate far more energy than your home needs. So then on one hand, you can generate that power with no waste products. You get warm water that you might use for washing as the only other byproduct except for electricity. But it also means that you could sell power back to the grid. That provides tremendous amount of flexibility in what's called a distributed generation sense.
But where's the fuel cell getting the energy? You said you use hydrogen.
You use hydrogen. So in the same way that you have natural gas either piped to your home or fuel oil delivered to your home in canisters, you would have the hydrogen delivered to your home. Or you could make it yourself if you had, for example, solar panels on your roof or in a rural area, a windmill, and that can basically generate the hydrogen through electrolysis, just generating it from water. Now, that means that the fuel is very abundant. Right now, the only hurdle is that it's a little bit too expensive, but the prices have been dropping dramatically. But let me give you the other example of where fuel cells can just totally transform how we think about energy. Fuel cells are being developed right now for vehicles. And a fuel cell car typically needs a power plant that's 20 to 30 kilowatts in size. The amount of power that you use in your home is probably 2 to 5 kilowatts, meaning the max amount of power you need to run everything in your home on a maximum day when everything's on. If you have your fuel cell vehicle and you then drive it to work and leave it turned on and sell power back all day long while at work, then hop in your fuel cell car and drive home, plug it into your house, and generate the power you need at night, you then have this remarkable device that provides distributed power where you are.
But this is predicated on the idea that hydrogen supplies somehow are going to be made as abundant as natural gas is right now and as readily available as gas from gas stations is.
That's right. Well, in fact, hydrogen is in some ways an easier quantity to move around and deal with than gasoline. Hydrogen is the most abundant element on Earth and in the universe. It is an element that can be stored in tanks. It can be stored in gaseous form. It can be pumped into different kinds of solids, like graphite, and it can be stored in that solid and then brought out later on. And the other feature about hydrogen is that we already have the infrastructure to move it around. Many universities and laboratories and some companies use hydrogen in all sorts of processes. So right now, hydrogen is tanked around in trucks, in pipelines, and is sent to various destinations. It has some big advantages over gasoline. One feature about gasoline is, for example, that it can light on fire and burn. Hydrogen can too, but the conditions under which hydrogen is explosive or can burn are actually ones that are in some ways easier to control than gasoline.
So this is a possibility. Is there any sign that anybody is actually moving toward this?
There is. Right now, as I said, the fuel cells are about a factor of 5 to 10 too expensive to directly compete with existing technologies. But 5 years ago, they were a factor of 100 times too expensive. So things are changing rapidly. And what we're already seeing is a whole manner of hydrogen associations, planning operations in the U.S. and Europe and Japan. Already Iceland plans to convert their economy entirely to a hydrogen-based economy because they already have geothermal energy, which they will then use to generate hydrogen. They will then use for vehicles, buildings, et cetera. So we're seeing the beginnings of that transition. And there's sort of no more fundamental shift in how we think about energy than moving towards this hydrogen economy. Essentially, 100 years ago, we had a solid fuel economy. We burned coal. Then we moved into a liquid economy where we did oil. And now we're seeing the beginnings of a gas economy with natural gas. And eventually, this hydrogen transition looks like one of the really promising, exciting ways to get clean energy.
Tell me about a couple of other things. What's happening with solar power these days? Because for a while, you know, in the 80s, you saw solar panels on some houses, and some people were really committed to solar power, but it remained kind of a fringe technology. Is that changing?
That's changed as dramatically as the fuel cell case has changed. Right now, we're seeing in California that has some very generous rebates from the state government if you put solar panels on your roof, a system where you can put the system on, get a tax break, which is essentially half the cost of the system, generate your power for your home, and do it with a payback time for that system that's under 5 years. Now, 5 years ago, the payback time, if you put a solar panel system on your roof to generate all the power for your home, was more than a decade, and in many cases, more than 2 decades. It's already come down by a factor of 4. That's a dramatic change.
It also used to be that if you wanted to do that, you had to be really committed to it, and you had to know something about the technology yourself and be prepared to go up there and, you know, monkey around with your solar panels if there was a problem. That's different, too?
That's also different. Now we are seeing companies out there that install your solar system, that maintain it, just the same way that you call up a company to have your furnace or your air conditioner managed. Mm. The other big change in solar is that the types of materials to make efficient solar panels have also transformed. You can now buy solar panels that look like and act like roof shingles, so you can actually have your roof itself generating power. And we're seeing this not just in developed countries. We're seeing developing countries like Kenya that have more solar panels per capita than any country on the earth. And we're seeing that transition taking place so that last year, for example, more people bought solar panels in Kenya than were hooked up to the national grid. So it's not just a developed country phenomenon. It's taking place all over.
Wow, that's fascinating. Okay, what about wind?
Well, wind has undergone a transition that has shocked a lot of people. Wind is now cost competitive and in some cases cheaper than any of the new alternatives, meaning it is cheaper than coal, cheaper than oil, and is getting down in some cases to be the same cost as nuclear power, leaving the whole nuclear waste issue aside. And the big change is that wind is now a technology that we understand how to not only make the windmills themselves much more efficient, but also to make wind farms very efficient so that we're getting a lot of power out, not just dribs and drabs, 20, 30 kilowatts here and there, but hundreds of megawatts of power out of wind farms so they can effectively replace fossil fuel power plants.
Well, so far we've been talking about clean energy alternatives that are really very close to being put into practice. What about if we look farther ahead? You know, what's still in the laboratory that scientists are working on now?
Well, some of the neat things that we can think about down the road are everything from space-based power systems. And what I mean by that is solar panels and collection systems in space where we don't have the loss of energy as it passes through the atmosphere. Right now, if you put a solar panel on the surface of the Earth, you will have lost anywhere from 20 to 50 or more percent of the initial energy that was outside the atmosphere, just because the atmosphere attenuates it. If you put the panels in space, you generate a lot more power, and there are laboratories in Japan and Germany working on systems to beam that energy back down to Earth as microwaves. That's a system where we could have, you know, essentially unlimited area for energy collection, beaming it back down very safely. Microwaves are used all the time to transmit signals and energy all around right now. That's a system that has some very attractive long-term potential. And of course, the big lurking long-term energy source is fusion power.
Boy, the last time a lot of us heard about fusion, it was sort of cold fusion, and there was a big debacle, and it turned out not to be the dream everybody thought it was. Fusion's still around?
That's right. Now, cold fusion is a whole different story, and it's in fact largely an unfortunate story of some mismanagement and some deception in science. Cold fusion is sort of some mythical transformation in a test tube. Fusion, as it's being developed right now, is a much larger scale technology, where there's two basic competing ways to do it. One is to use very strong magnets to constrain a plasma, a high-temperature gas, that you then ram together to get the fusion energy out. The other competing technology is a laser-based system, where you have a little pellet of fuel and a high-intensity laser beam that crashes into it that generates the force to push the atoms together to get fusion energy out. Now, fusion hit a milestone 2 years ago. At the tokamak reactor in Princeton, they were able for a brief split second to generate more energy than they put into the magnets to keep it constrained. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but it's a real quantum leap in understanding and ability to manage the fusion system.
Is the idea about fusion that one day, instead of having nuclear reactors, we just have fusion reactors?
That's right. Now, that actually brings up an interesting point about fusion. The amount of energy that you can generate from basically smashing together hydrogen, again, this wonderfully common fuel source, is that the energy available in that is far greater than we get from fission, from current nuclear reactors. Fusion has the feature, though, that we don't yet know if it has the same scalable property as I mentioned for fuel cells. Mm. Right now, we're looking at fusion systems that are going to be quite large because you've got to have big magnets or big lasers. We don't know if we can make fusion systems as small as would run your home, as large as would run a big power plant. We suspect they're going to be larger systems, but that means they could be part of a backbone of what's called baseload generation, with distributed wind and solar and fuel cells as the things that make up the differences for individual homes. And so these things all have to be thought of as a package. You can't just say, our future in 50 years will be all solar, all wind, all fusion. It's going to be a combination.
Daniel Kamen directs the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley. He talked with Ernst Strainchamps.
All of the fat cats, fur coats, brass hats got a big investment in the energy scam. Tell it to the banker, buy a super tanker. Where you get the money, where you get it off of Sam. Let Uncle sign the note, fill up your big boat. You bring it to the harbor, then you let it sit a while. You won't have to long to wait until the price is escalating. Then you sell your oil and you make yourself a pyre. Then you can allow yourself to smile. Let the sun shine, heat up the water. Let all the water turn in steam. Let the steam drive all the generators, keeping on the engine humming like a dream. What the boys don't want, can't have, won't want, don't want anybody getting power from the sun. No way to squeeze tight, corner all the sunlight, wrap it up a cellar, yes, and charge everyone. Every day it rises in the skies, you can bet on it, you can set your watch by, it happens every time. Shines on the poor folks, my folks, your folks, happens every morning and it doesn't cost a dime. And that to the hustlers is a crime. Let the sun shine, heat up the water, let all the water turn in steam. Let the steam drive all the generators, keeping on the engine humming like a dream.
What's more now?
Let the sun shine, heat up the water, let all the water turn in steam. Let the steam glide, all the generators, keeping on the engine humming like a dream.
Tom Paxton with Let the Sun Shine. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Oil's Well That Ends Well. Yeah, I know. The Three Stooges came up with that title first. Anyway, it's program number 1223A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Ann Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert, with engineering help from Marv Nunn. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, you can write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or send us email through our website at www.wpr.org/book.
PRI, Public Radio International.